On this edition of the Car Jam podcast.
Poor car just got spanked and it took it.
Sometimes I see adverts for cars and they say, you know, this was an original press launch car. And I think, well,
that's not
a good thing.
No. I think it was in the back of Autocar. They used to put in these little fake post-it notes. If only everything in life was as reliable as a Volkswagen. And my desk got covered in them.
About 20 cars in that class, 40 cars. Three.
How many years since I wrote this? There are a fair few, yes.
Well, that's all I can say. This wasn't a ghost-written book. You didn't have it written for you, did you?
Yes, on that famous, yeah.
Once we start, we can't stop. That's it. It's all, like, as live. The great thing is Tony's going to leave all this in because the quicker we get to 45 minutes, the better.
What I do is I produce a fancy intro and then that kind of opens the podcast and then Mike starts with something vaguely entertaining that he's been preparing for the last 2 days.
What a build-up, eh? What a build-up.
Mike preparing something.
Can this man promote or what? Hey, Car Chum again. Tony, go next door and borrow some chairs. We've got another guest.
The three-legged chair?
The rickety one. The one that won't take more than 10 stone in weight. We'll be fine. No, we have in our midst writer and author. Some people would say they're the same thing. Mr. Simon Charlesworth. Now, what we normally do, Simon, is we get the guests to sort of introduce themselves. So are you happy as being introduced as writer, author? Do you see yourself as something more or indeed less? Who are you and what do you do?
Professional word monkey probably is as close as it gets. Yeah, you're right. That'll be fine with me, what you said.
Great.
Underplay it.
Off to a flying start. So, I mean, you are a motoring journalist, I guess, aren't you? You make, or you have made most of your income through writing for car magazines. What was the big break? Where did it all begin?
That was probably starting getting a job in A&S Publishing, no longer exists, sadly, as a trainee production sub, working on Classic Ford and Golf Extreme magazines. The latter
Golf
I try
being,
not to mention.
Being a golfing magazine rather than a Volkswagen Golf, I presume.
No, a Volkswagen magazine.
A Volkswagen magazine.
There's another excellent question, Mike. Thanks.
see what normally people do research. Not in this case. We just like to wing it and sort of see what happens. So, okay, just for people who may not understand, what does a sub do?
They correct a copy which is sent into the magazine and make sure that it is grammatically correct, that it is spelt correct, and then it is laid out by a designer, and then you have to go through it all again to proofread it, and then when mistakes end up being produced in print, you tend to get a bollocking. That's really what it is. It's grammar Nazi is another way of putting it, if you like. It was a good training ground really for writing, mm-hmm. because you saw how to do it and how not to do it. That was probably the big break. I mean, before that, I'd worked on a local paper, working as a freelance part time on night shift, trying to upload motoring content to the local newspaper's website, which was horrific. Because the guy who has trained me was interested in websites of more of an adult nature, shall we say. And he didn't realise that you actually could delete the history afterwards. So all the guys who came in on day shift could see exactly what he'd been looking at.
a good introduction to various things then.
Yes, you entered a boy and left a man.
Steady time.
I think that was on his history as well.
Mike, I was wondering, Simon's making me think there. I mean, does Car Chum need a sub editor? You know, would that
help? Badly.
would that help our quality? Yeah.
Yes. Yes, anything would help, wouldn't it? Yeah. Trouble is, it's a bit difficult to sub this because it's already done by the time it's on. Yeah. See, that would be a prime example of needing subbing. Could have turned that into a proper sentence. So where do the interesting cars come from, Simon?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. My mum remembers me dragging her from car to car as a toddler on the street. And I just don't know. I think it's possibly genetic. The grandfather I never knew, he died just before I was born, had raced motorcycles at Brooklands. Ooh. And I keep meaning to try and do some research into that. So he might have been the carrier for the gene. I don't know. But
I thought you were going to say I keep meaning to race motorcycles at Brooklands.
No. Yeah, well, I'd love to. Yeah,
yeah. Quite a short race, really. Exactly. Wouldn't it?
Step one: learn how to ride a bike. I keep meaning to see if there's any if that is true or if it was a sort of myth that had been sort of slightly changed over time, you know, Chinese whispers.
Family folklore, yes.
Family folklore, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It.
Or, do you know, yeah. it's an interesting point you're saying, you know, is it genetic? Because not that I wasn't listening to your answer, obviously, Simon, but I was busy thinking about myself when you asked that question, Mike.
Thanks, Tony.
Do come again. You know, kind of what got me into it, and I know no one asked me, but same sort of thing.
What got you into cars?
Thank you. Parents not into it. Grandparents. I don't think there's any lineage really. But you talk about you dragging your mother, you know, around the car park as a toddler. You know, I remember thinking about it, cars this is we're on, very early on, you know, that it was just there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I certainly my sort of paternal grandfather's one who died before I was born, but my maternal grandfather, I mean, I remember regularly going out with him and in the back of a Mark III Cortina. And invariably, we'd stop for petrol, and near the petrol station, there used to be a post office, and they used to sell Matchbox Superfast, which I still have them in very battered state. So that was really, that was obviously fanning whatever was there really sort of get it going.
Weird coincidence here, actually, because was that your grandfather, did you say?
Yeah, yeah.
Maternal grandfather.
Yes, maternal grandfather.
Sorry, if you've just tuned in, this does sound like we're doing some kind of family tree show. It's not, but
some kind of cross examination more than anything.
No. My maternal grandfather, one of my first memories is also a Mark III Cortina, and his was a 2000E. What beat that?
Oh, I can't. It was a 2000 XL. It had special order jade green metallic, which meant that you couldn't go through a car wash because it would just attack the paint.
Really?
Yeah. That's why it ended up in a horrible sort of matte colour. I only got rid of it. God. Kid came around knocking on the door, said he was going to restore it, but I suspect it was bangered. Just before I went into, a group of us clubbed together to rent a large shed to put full of tomorrow's classics, junk in other words, and I just got rid of the Cortina just before that happened. I don't know what happened to it. I still got the back seat, which is the bit that I used to sit on, but
just a bit that applied to you.
Sofa.
Yeah. Have you actually made it? Have you made it into a sofa, or have you just literally
not yet?
Got
no. It is
that's
currently
as well.
Yes, yes. That's. I'm very good at procrastination. I've got a black belt in it, so it's going to take a while before that gets done.
So, what are the kind of highlights of the car ownership you've had over the years? Or the highlights and the lowlights? We don't often ask what's the first car because that's a security question for many people. But what's the sort of what are the interesting things you used to own? We'll come on to what you do own in a minute, but what have you had over the years that sticks in the mind?
Well, I'll start with the worst car I had, which is a Mark II Golf Driver, which I bought because they were reliable, and it wasn't. The Peerbert had a semi-auto choke on it, which that had to go. And luckily, working for a golfer, VW magazine, I managed to get the carburetor done on the free. So that improved it to a degree, but then it ended up sucking in so much cold air that it started to ice up in the winter, and it would. I ended up having to blag Rolling Road Sessions to try and get it to work properly. So they put some ducting on it to get some hot air into it. Right. It was just always breaking down one thing or the other, and it coincided with the time that I think it was in the back of Autocar. They used to put in these little fake post-it notes, these yellow ones, which said if only everything in life was as reliable as a Volkswagen. And my desk got covered in them because working for a motor publisher. And they took great delight in this car, which I just hated it. And I probably do have a VW phobia because of it, because it was awful. It didn't handle very well.
Looked good on the steel wheels, though. The driver model had the circular hold steel wheels. Is that
right? That's
right.
Yeah. It kind of looked like a GTI, but it wasn't. It was a bit more hinge and bracket, and it had finishers on it as well. So you had two piece plastic. You had the plastic wheel trim in the middle, and then it had a plastic finisher going around the outside as well, which you obviously scuffed each time you went anywhere near a curb. But it was, the 1600 with a Weber on it, it would go. But as soon as you came to a corner or even expansion joints, you got terrible corkscrewing motion. You made you slightly seasick. It was just, it was a car I never got on with.
Was it like a cut and shut or something, was it?
It had 40,000 miles on the clock when I got it, and one previous owner.
A likely story. So what came after the Golf?
Well, I replaced that with a Focus, which is probably one of the best cars I've had, a Mark One, 1.8 ZTEC, the rare three-door model. I remember driving that back from where I bought it, and I nearly crashed into a roundabout, because when I turned the steering wheel, it actually responded. Unlike the VW. So it was an instant recalibration.
The Focus was an incredible step forward, wasn't it? I mean, after the disaster of the last generations of Escort, all based on the same platform, which were pretty poor, the world was changing for Ford drastically at that point, wasn't it? The Mondeo, the Focus, even the revamped and reheated old Fiesta was getting so much better, and that Focus is gaining popularity. That is a future classic, isn't it? I think that the Mark.
Yes, I mean all those cars were developed under Richard Parry Jones, who was brilliant when it came to ride and handling, and the Focus especially was a car which I loved massively, because it you could just leave it anywhere, it did everything, it had a huge boot on it as well when you put the seats down, and it was just great fun to drive and economical. Sadly, rust killed it in the end. It nearly survived 144,000 miles of me driving, which my theory is that a motor journalist mile is like dog years. They're seven to a one motor journalist mile is seven to a normal people. So because I remember on a contract I had, rather than coming down from Gloucester on the M5, I just came down the A38 each time, and it was just the poor car just got spanked, and it and it took it.
It's true. Sometimes I see adverts for cars and they say, you know, this was an original press launch car. And I think, well, that's not a good thing.
No.
The first time I ever drove a Focus, I was working work experience on a car magazine, and they'd been out, I guess, about a month. So there was quite a lot of excitement because we got this thing from one of the car rental companies, and we were doing a shoot on an airfield. And they'd said to me, you know, we'll take like the feature car down over there somewhere for photos, bring the Focus back, but go round the edge of the runway, don't get in shot. So I had to go quite a long way up the runway and then back down. And I thought, hey, brand new Focus on a runway, here we go. So got this thing up to about 100, 110, and then realised the runway was very rapidly ending. It was only about a 2 mile straight. There's probably somewhere photos of just clouds of brake and tyre smoke, because I locked the thing up big time and still went about 50 feet onto the grass on the end. And I hit at least two of those little marker light things they have on the end of runways, because they're bang, 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 gling, gling, gling. I'd say this Focus had about 90 miles on it. So I got it back without anybody saying anything, but it was, you know, heart in the mouth kind of thing. I was only about 19 at the time, didn't know what I was doing. So, as you say, press cars, yes, they got a proper thrashing. Yeah. And it's funny when you see all these Fords and, you know, Cosworths and Escorts, and, oh, it was the Motor magazine car they had on test for 3 months, and you think that thing must have been rebuilt 9 times before it went back to Ford. You know, they are hammered, aren't they? Have you done sort of many press launches, Simon? Is it
a few over the years, but actually the Ford story is one reason why I kind of stopped doing new car stuff, because when they replaced the Mark 1 Focus with the Mark 2, it just wasn't very good. I mean, apart from the ST and then later the RS, which is great because it was sort of like a Dagenham Quattro, but it handled.
Oh, good phrase. I like that.
But, you know, it was obvious, and they did the same with the Fiesta, the same with the Ford Ka as well. That was shared underpinnings with the Panda and the Cinquecento, and these cars were sort of losing, you know, their brilliance in a way. I mean, I always thought that, you know, a new car should be better. Yeah, well, yes, there was the design as well, but they should be better than their predecessors. But this was not happening. Sowed the seed of doubt, and then more black boxes, more interference, and I just thought, nothing. I can't write about any of this anymore. So that was why I sort of ventured more into classic car stuff, really, which is far more enjoyable.
Best Ford ever made? People's opinions over the years. I sprung that on them now. There's a moment of silence.
I'm going to say the Focus, the original Focus. I remember chatting to its designer Claude Lebeau. They also did, actually, because that was the New Edge era, which is very much evident on the Mark 1 Focus and the original car. And they did a Mondeo as well, which never made production with New Edge on it. Instead, they went for the second generation platform, which is sort of a Passata-like from the period. It was far more Germanic and toned down. And you do kind of wonder what that car would have looked like. I suspect somewhere it's on the internet. But I'd say that the Focus was really, you know, it's such a jump. When Ford makes an effort after the disaster of the last of the Escorts, that Focus was a great car.
I'd go Plain Jane, actually, just based purely on personal experience. I've had several Sierras over the years, including sort of an XR4 before and whatnot, which was, you know, great fun. 1800L Pinto Sierra. Just a great car. I mean, just a really, really good car of its time. Obviously, it didn't handle great, didn't do anything great, actually, to be honest. But it did work, and it was fixable by anyone. And I think that's one of the big charms of a brand like Ford, is, you know, is the universal ease of the product. And I think that's forgotten sometimes, you know, where we get swept along as journalists talking about, you know, the minutiae of things that, that actually probably don't affect people hugely, most people, let's be honest. Yeah. What does is kind of put the key in, does it work? And then when it doesn't work, can I get it fixed easily? And I think the Sierra was a very good example of that.
Of course, we have two people here who can vouch for the crashability of its successor, the Mondeo.
Yes. I was going to say my favourite and least favourite Ford. The best car I ever owned was a Mark 1 Mondeo, and I rolled it end over end into a field. So at that point, it wasn't the best car I'd ever owned, but up until then, it did nothing wrong, and I still feel so bad because that car was on its second battery. It had 120,000 miles on it. It was a family car for about 12 years until I wrote it off. And it went through two sets of brake pads, original exhaust, original clutch, 120,000. Nothing went wrong on that car. It needed an indicator bulb and tyres, and that was the only thing that ever went wrong on it, and I still regret to this day. I hit a patch of oil. It wasn't my terrible driving. Hit a patch of oil, and it just slewed and went through a hedge and went end over end, and I walked away with a slight scratch and a bit of a concussion, so I still think fantastic car, the Mondeo. It saved my life. You wrecked one as well, didn't you, Simon?
I did.
Can you tell us that story, is that...
It was the office hack at the publishing company. It had been the boss's car. Was it Signal Red, Radiant Red? I can't remember. It's that sort of flat red. It's a 1.8 LX with huge mileage on it. And the thing is, they had, probably most cars still do, an adaptive ECU on it. So if it was used to being spanked, it gave more power. And this thing was always, you know, driven like it had been stolen. And I'd been sort of put in charge of editing a Fast Forward special, Cosworth 4. And we'd been very busy doing this, that, and the other thing. And I was just about to take this car home so I could get an early start in the morning up to, I think it was a drag strip for something. Of course, I never got there. It was on the A38 out of Gloucester, past the Quedgeley traffic lights, and they have a roundabout on the dual carriageway, which they'd offset, obviously, to stop people try to straight line it and take the racing line. No one was ever on this roundabout until this fateful day. And I was going through it, Carlos Fandango style, and all of a sudden there's a recovery truck blocking my exit. And we went, you know, right up the back of it. I managed to steer at the one bit which was deformable, which was its sort of rear section bodywork in between the large joist and the huge wheel. Airbag went off, you know, the full works. And the police turned up, and my hand was all swollen and horrible from the airbag, and I had my I was cautioned and this, that, and the other thing. But what he had been doing was he was recovering a box van which had been poorly loaded with one-armed bandits. And they'd all been loaded in this box van on the left-hand side. So when he'd gone round the roundabout, the thing had just toppled over. So after my... quite spectacular crash. It led to the great Gloucester recovery truck shortage because I needed one, the box van needed one, and then the recovery truck needed a recovery truck. And the best thing about that was, I don't know if it was a year or two later when I left the company, and everyone signs a card about leaving. One of the editors that I worked with had found out it had gone through all the transparencies, and he needed to have, because I thought, why do you need to see, you know, shots of the, it's called the Red Shed. Why do you need that? And he just went like that. And when I opened the card on the day I left, and it had the number plate, "See you in hell." which was the message, so say, from the Mondeo, which was due to. So, yeah, you know, they, and then I got a job because I said, well, you haven't lived because until you've tasted airbag. And they like that phrase.
Yeah, I've never, yeah. I've often wondered. So did you get any facial burns? You got the hand thing. Was it dusty?
It was dusty. I think it brushed my top lip. It happens quite quickly, obviously, because the other thought is, oh, God, how am I going to explain this to the boss?
can I get away with it? Yeah. What do you notice there's an airbag deployed? Is that the sort of thing people spot?
Looking like a handkerchief for you top pocket. Yeah, it looks it's a new look.
Queen Victoria's underwear all suddenly all over the place. Yeah, it just goes like this. It's the violence of it. I mean, when you crash anyway... It's a violent thing, but the airbag is not this sort of gentle pillow that comes out and helps you. It's just like, bang, you know, right in your face. And it's just, it's unpleasant. It really is. I wouldn't recommend it.
So the thing with mine, because I went end over end, the front bumper never touched the ground. So the airbag didn't go off.
I think if I remember correctly, someone else... That was replaced by a second jet or a Mark III Mondeo wagon. Mm. And I think that was crashed as well. That was red as well. I won't mention his name. I can't remember if it was a junction accident or something. I can't remember what it was, but it did set a precedent in the company. I think somebody else put one through a fence or something that ended up partially in a Chinese takeaway. I can't remember, but they're all these sort of things that happen, which, you know, it's what happens when you hire young hot shoes and all this sort of stuff.
Because the publishing company that I worked for, we took over some of the old ANS titles.
Yeah.
And I know we did inherit a Mondeo, but I don't know if it was ones that... But I recall, I mean, certainly when we came to sell it, somebody bought the car, and then later one of the guys recognised the car. And, oh, yeah, we used to own that. And the guy went, yeah, it's amazing condition. It's fantastic. Mm. And the guy said, it's not really. He said, we, like 20 of us, used to learn to drift in it. You know, that was the car we used to take out on the weekend, and we'd teach everybody how to drift. And it had also had some sort of... engine modifications. I think they had the ECU had been done on something, or else like the turbo had been uprated in it. But that was done supposedly at ANS, and then we insured it as a completely standard vehicle for about 3 years, not realising it was modified at about 50 more brake horse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there was a sudden kind of, wait a minute, you know, we've not technically been insured for the last 2 or 3 years on this because it's a modified car. Again, how much truth there was in that, I don't know, but that was a rumour that went round at one point.
It's not it's not just the blue oval, though, Simon, is it? You've got a bit of a thing about Bristols.
Haven't we all?
Oh, sorry, but honestly, you know, I've heard that gag a few times. It's just the Bristols gag. The Bristol types. So is he trying to palm off the fanar?
I had a lot of fun telling people that you wrote a big book on Bristols.
I bet you did, yes. It's...
Particularly non-car people. In case anyone is listening and is not aware of Cockney rhyming slang, Bristol cities is rhyming slang for a certain part of a woman's anatomy. So... that's the joke.
Yes.
that's that element of the show dealt with. Bristol cars, on the other hand, you've got a little bit of a thing for. Is this right?
Well, yes.
I mean, I know it's right, but
yes, I was born just down the road from where they were originally built. And
Filton.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but I was obviously on the Bristol side because of that's. See the superior side of the border. That'll annoy everyone in South Gloucestershire. Yes, I think the first time I drove anything with a Bristol engine, it was an AC Ace Bristol.
Nice.
And it was just a lovely thing. And I sort of thought, okay, I probably, you know, coming from the area, I probably should try and look a bit more into the car company that was on my doorstep. And yeah, I've driven all the six-cylinder cars easily. I've driven a fair few of the V8s, driven a couple of fighters. I've met many people who worked at the factory, and of course was ideal background really for doing a book on the racing department, which is
we'll talk about the book in a sec, but I think it's probably worth giving a little outline as to what Bristol was, because it doesn't exist anymore. It went bust, didn't it? Bust twice, didn't it? And it's finally gone now. But a very, very bespoke manufacturer, about 100 cars a year at tops. Is that about right?
I think they built in total between 45, 46 when they started, and when they closed the factory in 2010 or 2011?
2011,
I think they built fewer than 3,000 cars in total. Right. So it was, you know, I think it might be closer to 2,500. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, they started out by building everything to aircraft standards, which is slightly nutty, and is why they never made any money out of it at all. But it was purely one of the many diversifications after the war to try and keep the workforce in work. And they'd done it to a lesser degree after the end of the Great War. So they sort of repeated it again. But of course, at the end of the Second World War, you ended up with the Cold War and the change from propeller aircraft to jets and all this, and turboprops as well. So that was very intensive when it came to manpower. So
they had an association with BMW after the Second World War, didn't they? Was it war preparation that got them
based on a
BMW engine, or what's the proper story there?
It's very similar to the BMW M328, which is the engine that was used in the 328 and the 32780, which is the 2-litre six-cylinder with a forest of push rods and little hemispherical combustion chambers on it. Mm. Yes, it happened because before the war, Fraser-Nash had an agreement to supply. They're basically the concessionaire for the UK, and they had an agreement also to build BMWs in the UK. That never happened because of the war. And after the war, they tried to resume that, but they didn't have the capacity to build it. So they approached Bristol. Bristol acquired them briefly, very briefly, before they ended up divorcing. And they went their own separate ways. So you ended up with sort of Fraser-Nash sports cars with the engine in it. And then you have predominantly sort of large GTs, one saloon from Bristol after that. So that's where it came from. As far as Bristol is concerned, money was sent with the Aldingtons from Fraser-Nash to acquire the plans and some hardware from BMW after the war. Whether or not that money ever made it is a question mark or whatever. But the thing about war reparations is a little bit of a myth.
Okay.
Sorry to get sensible there. That's
No,
it's
right.
Interesting.
I'm just
because
I'm just going to
make notes.
I was just going to cross out some of the words in half the books I've got behind me because they say that, but I believe you've done the research, whereas a lot of these sort of the A to Z of cars books don't tend to have. They tend to just repeat the myths. So
It is one of the things that often gets Bristol is, because for many years it was sort of a closed door really to publicity. There is a lot which is not really known or clear about them because of this sort of secrecy under the former owner, Tony Crook. I think, you know, there are people who just sort of, it's almost like they write on what they think they know rather than what is actually true.
But that's all right. We speak that instead of writing it. Bristol had one dealer, and they ended up moving from that six cylinder to a Chrysler V8, didn't they? Extraordinary. Look, you either love Bristols or you don't. You either get it or you don't. They were 70s onwards, extraordinary looking cars. I mean, the proportions are just bloody odd. cutting to the, aren't they? I mean, they are. The proportions are weird. The spare wheels shoved up in the front wing. The rear screen. Everything's odd. The track's too narrow. It's just everything's weird about them. You either get it or you don't. I don't. I'll be honest with you. I like the earlier ones, the six cylinder ones, the 400s or whatever. They're unusual. Slightly BMW-esque grill. I presume that's not a chance thing, is it? The earlier ones, they had a sort of kidney grill.
Yeah. Twin kidneys.
Yeah. Or Bratwurst grills, as they were at that point.
Right.
Yeah, the 400, and then they used it on the 401 and its relatives, the 402 and the 403, that had the kidney grills as well.
And that was the most comfortable looking period, wasn't it? Because once you get
I think you're right. It's fair to say that when the company was still owned by the aeroplane company, up to and including the 406, just about, the cars are probably the most successfully styled. Then they got 407 to 411. They're more or less variations on the similar three-box theme. They're fine. There is an acquired taste, I'd certainly say, in the 70s for the 412 and the 603 and its later versions as well. They are, they can be a challenge. But the problem is, the longer you look at them, certainly in my case, I sort of get them. Either that or I need an eye test, I don't know, but they're just eccentric cars which not many people know, but they do actually pull a crowd when you're working with them. You will get people stopping and saying, what is it? Which usually the answer usually either draws a blank or there'll be a glim recognition in their eyes.
They appeal to a certain type of person, and this was illustrated to me by a girlfriend I had years ago, who was describing, she had a mad aunt who used to live in a caravan and owned a double-barreled shotgun and used to just randomly fire it into the air. And she, you know, a lovely old girl. And she said she had, I'm sure she had a Bristol at one point. I thought, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
And Bristol had a reasonably successful racing career, didn't they? Which leads us
to the
cleverly
book.
to a book you've written. Aerodynamic: How Bristol Won at Le Mans.
Yes, that's right. Yes,
give us a bit of background to how this won publication of the year last year, which I know you're too modest to mention. Probably not.
Yeah, I'm far too modest to mention it at all. You know, it's just
you just happened to have a copy.
He just happened to have a copy of the award. That's the award.
Rather nice. Yeah,
yes, it is, isn't it? It's quite well actually. So do some damage to that. It's really sharp on the corners.
And you had to carry that home on the train, did you?
I did, yeah. In a plastic bag, because I'm class. And it worked its way through slightly.
So how did you end up writing this book, which has been fabulously well received? And give us a bit of background and let us know what the book is about, if the title doesn't give it away enough.
I think it does, Mike.
Yeah. The simple answer is I was asked to do it. They found this is the launch thing here, which I'm holding up. But this photograph here is one of a group of rare color photographs that were unearthed, because most of the photos of the type, which is the 450, are all in black and white. And these were found, and it was like, we could do a book around this. And my initial thoughts were, after saying yes, was, hold on, I've only ever seen features on this. There might be a little bit of a, it might be a bit thin. But after doing all the research and digging around and just managing to conclude it before lockdown started, it's a great story to write. I mean, they started by, they acquired the ERA G type and used that as the basis for the 450. They started that work in 1952. Their first race was Le Mans 53, double retirement, just what you want. And then they went to Reims because Reims and Le Mans, very fast circuits, and they had very tall gearing on these cars. And they had one retirement again because one of the drivers tried to start the car when it was already started.
Oh.
Yep. And that put them on tenterhooks. But the remaining car won the 2 litre class. So that was the first bit of good news for them. And then they decided to rebody it because the 53 car, if you think the 70s Bristol is an oddity, the 53 450 is, you know, part, you know, sort of coal scuttle, part Darth Vader's helmet. It's really, really strange looking thing. And then they redesigned it and they did a series of records at Montlhéry in late 53. And then it was just sort of better news from that. They managed to get first, second and third at Le Mans 54 in the 2 litre class. Mm. And Reims, they lost. They finished. They did quite well, but it was started to become obvious that that old BMW engine was starting to meet new technology, such as the quad cam Porsche engine or the twin cam Oscars from the Maserati brothers. And so after that, they thought, well, they couldn't get any more power out of it because of the limit of its design. So they ended up chopping the roof off to lower its frontal area. And they, again, first, second and third 2 litre class in 55, which, of course, is the tragedy, that horrific accident.
Yes.
And that really was the end of it because Reims was cancelled after that, after Le Mans.
When they were competing in the 2 litre class, and this is a bit of a vague question, but I mean, roughly how many other cars would they be competing against? They got first, second and third. Were there, you know, about 20 cars in that class, 40 cars, three?
Mike, you're a cruel swine asking that question. This is how many years since I wrote this? 3 years down the line. There are a fair few, yes. Well, that's all I can say. I mean, honestly. What were you doing 3 years? Yes, there were more than four, yeah.
This wasn't a ghost-written book. You didn't have it written for you, did you?
Yes, I'm that famous, yeah.
It's written it. It's just never read it. It's not had the time. It's too big. It's too long a book. It's too heavy to pick up.
This is really super crass, but I need to put it in perspective. This book is not something that one would pick up casually at Waterloo train station at the WH Smith. It's an investment piece, is it not?
That's true. Yeah, there are only 500 copies, so it's high end, I would say. Certainly, it's not incredibly high end. It's not a four-figure price, which some of them are, but it is. I mean, the quality. They had two teams of touching up specialists working on the photographs on it, and you sort of, you know, and they actually paid me some money as well to write it, as opposed to doing it for exposure, which Tesco's won't take. I've tried it, paying for my baked beans. But yeah, it is. It's about a foot square. It's a big chunky thing. You never pick it up casually anyway, wherever you are. It weighs a ton. It's, you know, top quality paper and it's gone down very well. So
it is a work of love, isn't it? Really,
yeah, it is.
And it, as you say, not just a casual thing. I mean, the subject matter alone is pretty specialist.
It is. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, you suddenly end up being a specialist in something which there's only one survivor of. That's useful.
Well, it is in a sense, because it makes it very difficult to question, doesn't it?
But... It does, yes. That's true, yeah. And you have to be quite careful with some of the information you uncover as well about certain things because of... people might not be happy about it. So, you have to be a bit tactful. And, but yes, it took about 2 or 3 years to write. I would say it probably took about 10 years in the background, knowing the lay of the Bristol land, if you like, because you have to know stuff because you're constantly referring to it. And another reason, of course, apart from 55 Le Mans, the tragedy, was that money was getting incredibly tight at BAC due to the Britannia airliner, which was the company's first turboprop. So you have to sort of know what you're talking about with that to a degree, which I roughly know the outline of it. I'm certainly not an aircraft specialist, but that is certainly part of the reason why the racing department was closed, sadly. So, yeah, that's a cheery note.
Okay. moving on from Bristol's, reluctantly, but moving on from Bristol's. What's on the fleet at the moment, Simon? What's in the garage?
I still have my first car, which I really should get on the road, which is a 69 Mark III Midget. And I've also got the reason why the Midget is not on the road, because it takes every spare shilling I've got, which is a 1978 Alfa Romeo Alfetta 2000.
That's rare. That's rare now.
Nice.
I had a Fiat 132, which in proportions, very similar, but they're not related really, are they? The Alfetta is a four-door saloon.
Yes, it was Alfa's response to BMW and the Neue Klasse and all that sort of stuff. And they went all out and decided to fit a transaxle on it, which is the gearbox at the back in line with the diff. Great weight distribution and this, that, and the other thing. And, they were just taking on so much because they had the Sud going on then as well. They'd not long done the Montreal. There's the racing programs and all sorts. And the ambition was just nuts. And they found that each and every Alfetta, the gear change had to be individually set up on the production line. Whereas now they it's because of the linkage from the gear stick to the gearbox at the back. Just because, now you will get, if you see a modern car with a transaxle, they tend to have all the linkages in like a tube. So it's all been done beforehand by whoever you get the gearbox from. Whereas Alfa, bless them, they found out all of this beforehand. And it was a pioneering car because Porsche benchmarked it for the 924, and it's later ones where it decided to put the engine in the right place.
One dream car, what's your dream car? And it probably varies, I know mine varies from day to day, but at the snapshot of this moment,
I did a shoot not very long ago, was it a year or 2 years ago, where somebody turned up with there's another Alfa GTV6 2.5, which is the Busso-engined coupe that had been to Alex Dupe, who's one of the leading specialists in the transaxle Alphas. And you could change gear on it properly because they need a little bit of a coaxing. I mean, even when they're being perfectly set up with standard stuff like mine has been, it's first to second requires a little bit of a patience and a guiding hand. But this GTV6, if they'd all driven and handled like that, Porsche wouldn't have stood a chance of the 924 or the 944. They'd have been queued around the block. That was a lovely thing. I've driven quite a few of the 1930-35 MGs, what they call the triple Ms, which are the little overhead cam things, highly supercharged. They're a joy as well, but they're just out of my price bracket. There's no way I can do that. But pre-war is another thing as well, because I think the longer that you fiddle around with old cars, your tastes get older as well, because, you know, you realize that the driving experience is less and less filtered with the older you go back. So if you do like driving, then it's kind of inevitable, really. It's you could draw an analogy with harder drug use, if you like, but probably best not to.
you could. I think we've all experienced both, yeah. I find I drive slower now. In old cars, there's no hurry anymore. I don't care and sod the people behind me. I just drive at the speed limit and enjoy the car now.
Well, you know, even if you do drive quickly, the chances are you'll probably either bump into a little Nazi in a van who will fine you, or there'll be some sort of Reginald Mole husband type, you know, adenoids, who has filmed you in his little dash cam and then reported you to the police. So, you know, it's a lovely world out there at the moment. But if you have to drive something which is quite challenging or whatever, you know, like my midget, I mean, that's great fun at 30 miles an hour or 60 miles an hour, and you get all that feedback, and you could play around with it, and you won't get into trouble or on the front cover of the Daily Mirror, which certainly with the modern performance stuff, you know, even when I was probably stopped doing that about 10 or 15 years ago. But I mean, some of the stuff when you were giving it the beans, it was just ridiculously quick. And some of the performance figures, especially with these, sorry, I've got a slightly nasty taste in my mouth, electric cars, they're just ridiculous. They shouldn't really be. The performance capabilities of them without any extra driving training is just nuts. It really is. But old cars, yeah, they're just more fun, really. They just are.
We normally round off with Mike's question at the end, which is a question about questions.
Can you lend me a grant? No. Simon, thank you for joining us. That's been great. I hope you enjoyed it. Feel free to say you have.
Checks in the post, right?
Yeah. No.
From the Bank of Exposure.
And if you think your coffee table can take it, Simon's fabulous book that he might have mentioned is available directly from Butterfield Press. Simon accidentally agreed to join us again sometime in the future. I've got that bit recorded, so as far as I'm concerned, that's a binding contract. Hopefully you'll be around then too, and for the next edition of Car Chum as well. In the meantime, keep up to date with us socially on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. Just search Car Chum. Until next time, pip pip.